This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
I'm Katia Adler from the Global Story podcast, where we're looking at the US election and the huge sums of money, billions of dollars being spent by Republicans and Democrats hoping to win in November. Who's donating the cash? And what impact does it all have on American democracy? The Global Story brings you fresh takes and smart perspectives from BBC journalists around the world. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.
Across Northern Ireland, on your radio and on BBC Sounds. This is
The Stephen Dolan Show!
Good morning, everyone. My goodness, I'm in fine form today. Are you? I don't know. You get up in the morning, you hit 51, you've all these aches and pains, but you still have a wee smile on your face and a wee teddy bear on your shirt. What are we talking about in the programme today? I can't remember. Can any of you lot remind me? What did we talk about 10 minutes ago? Look, they're not listening. Not a word. Stormont. We're talking about Stormont. That's right. The Assembly are back. The programme for government. That's what we were talking about this morning. So it's all coming up. This is a terrible introduction, isn't it? See, I'm a bit... Woo! Good, eh? What's wrong with me? I'm happy. Do you remember that song? Can we find that song? Do you remember it was there was a programme set? Are any of you listening to me? There was a programme set in a... Some of you are probably too young. There's a programme set in a hospital. And the theme music used to go, I'm H-A-P-P-Y. I'm H-A-P-P-Y. No? No? Just play it under this and the listeners will know.
I'm H-A-P-P-Y. I'm H-A-P-P-Y. I know I am, I'm sure I am. I'm H-A-P-P-Y.
I know I am, I'm sure I am. He's H-A-P-P-Y.
The Stephen Dolan Show!
We're just looking at a story here before we get into the programme for government. We're looking at a story that we've been working on over the last 60 minutes or so. I just want to bring you details about this. And it is that a police officer, a PSNI officer, while on duty yesterday, was knocked down in the Belmont Road area of Belfast. Now, we understand that that officer then lay there at the side of the road, incapacitated. He was injured and lay there for hours waiting for an ambulance. I'll give you some of the background to the detail that we know already about this. But obviously, it raises questions. We know that our ambulance service is under pressure and we know that they triage calls, given the pressure they're under, based on clinical need. So they rush the ambulances out to life-threatening conditions, and this officer wasn't in a life-threatening condition. And they rush ambulances out to life-threatening conditions first. But what are the protocols? What are the safety implications, given the terrorist threat in Northern Ireland? If there's an officer lying there, is he a sitting duck, lying at the side of the road for hours, not able to get up, not able to move? It's not that long ago that dissidents shot a police officer in this country. There is still a threat. Gordon Downey was a senior police officer in the PSNI. You're a former Bronze Commander in the Armed Response Unit. What's this feel like to you, Gordon? An officer on the ground, left in Belfast for hours.
It's a rather poor showing, all in all. I can't understand how someone who had been knocked down and had a dislocated shoulder was left lying on the ground for 2 hours. It just doesn't make much sense.
What are the security implications for that?
Well, first of all, the person will have to be treated for their injuries by police, waiting for the ambulance to come. And what happens then is driven by what that person can tolerate in relation to maybe them taking them to hospital themselves. But obviously police will then have to guard this officer because they will be incapable of defending themselves if something untoward would happen. So it has a drain on policing, where police have to wait until the ambulance come. Conversely, when the ambulance does come, police will have to go with the officer until they're in some semi-secure environment. Then the officer will be disarmed because obviously they can't do much with their firearm at that time. And then they'll have to be guarded until the officer is facilitated by being put into, for instance, pyjamas, plain clothes, if they're going to be kept in. And then they'll have to do a risk assessment in relation to what level of protection that person gets, depending on the threat and risk at that time.
There was, Gordon, an unmarked police car there. We understand that. But news can travel quickly. So what would you have been, in terms of the security threat to that officer, lying on the ground for hours, you know, how agile are the dissidents?
It depends on the area in which it took place.
It took place in the Belmont Road area.
It's not likely that attack could be mounted in a short period of time like that. However, one can never rule out the possibility that an attack can take place.
But what can you do if those ambulances are rushing? I just wonder what the protocols are. How much, if the ambulances are rushing to more clinically important cases, is it just about wrapping some type of security around that officer as he lies on the ground?
Yep, that's going to be it. No, it can be driven on what the officer can tolerate in relation to pain. If I were there or other people, you'd be asking, do you think you can get into your saloon car? Could we get a Land Rover here, for instance, and you can lie down in the back of the ambulance and the Land Rover, and we can convey you to hospital? So there, all the options are available. There are police officers who are advanced first aiders, for instance, within armed response, specialist operations, and leading tactical support group, who have got advanced first aid, where they would be more able to deal with that person and get them to hospital safely. But it's shocking where a police officer has to lie on the ground for 2 hours, waiting for injured on duty, waiting for someone to take him to hospital.
There are two different stories here, aren't there? One is the state of our health service, how resources are stretched for any of us, whether we're a police officer or a civilian. And then the separate story here, which we're concentrating on this morning, is what are the protocols? What are the safety implications? You know, we've seen many times in Northern Ireland police officers getting attacked. One was lying on the ground, incapacitated. How many police resources were there protecting this officer? We can give you some of the background of what happened. The driver, the police tell us, failed a breath test at the scene and a fitness test. During the arrest, the driver struck out at another officer. The driver was arrested on suspicion of driving while unfit through drink and drugs, careless driving causing grievous bodily injury, assault on police and resisting police. So that was the behaviour, the alleged behaviour, according to the PSNI, of the person who was driving that car. What might that person have done to the police officer on the ground?
Yeah, well, again, Northern Ireland being what it is, it's too early to say whether it was an unintended collision or potentially could it be an intended collision. What was that person's intent? Obviously, that's going to come out in the investigation proper. When it goes to court, the person will have the answer for their actions. But in relation to the officer's safety, Belfast Regional Control will be made aware, and then they will assign police officers to guard or mind that police officer on the ground, give them first aid and await till the ambulance comes. So the area in which it is, it's not unreasonable for one car to with two people to stay with that officer. And being Belfast, more people can come very quickly if required. But again, it's dependent on the area in which it takes place.
So what are you saying terrorists can't scramble across the city to Belmont Road?
Terrorists can, but terrorists are could be perceived to live in certain geographic areas. It wouldn't, and during the Troubles, that terrorists could mount an attack very, very quickly. Now, it's far less likely, but it's not impossible.
Okay. All right. And the police are appealing for information. Anybody that was around the Belmont Road, Belmont areas, it was around about 3 o'clock yesterday afternoon, Sunday afternoon, who witnessed that collision. The police are asking for dash cam footage or doorbell footage to contact them. Gordon, thanks very much for coming on this morning at short notice. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Stephen.
Morning to you. 9:30:30:80:55:55. So the programme for government then will be delivered to MLAs today. They'll get a duke at it. We'll all get a duke at it too. Is this going to be some type of broad document that doesn't really give us any detail? And you know what happens in Northern Ireland when the detail isn't there? Sometimes nothing happens. I've been talking about this as the MLAs return to Stormont today after their summer break. Here's our political editor, Enda McLafferty.
Well, this is when the executive, if you like, gets down to business, Stephen, because they have now set out their 9 priorities as of last week. Today we're going to get some flesh on the bone in terms of how they're going to achieve the very many challenges and how they're going to meet them and how they're going to deliver to improve the lives of people in Northern Ireland. And let's not beat about the bush when you consider the challenges in health, the challenges in education, the sharp rise in femicide cases in Northern Ireland. Of course, that deals with violence against women and girls, not to mention, of course, the state of our public services. So they're facing battles on many, many fronts. And today we're going to get the first indication as how they plan to meet those challenges. Now, we know the 9 priorities, of course. We learned them last week. Includes cutting health waiting times, growing the economy, delivering affordable childcare, ending violence against women and girls, providing more social, affordable and sustainable housing. Loch Ness in there as well, protecting the environment and reforming public services, which is the big picture stuff. And I think today what we'll get, Stephen, is the executive trying to strike a balance between creating positivity around what they plan to do, say they're up for meeting this challenge, but I think also trying to manage expectations when you consider there's just 2.5 years to run on this current mandate. Normally, programme for governments run for 5 years. And let's not forget the financial constraints. Keir Starmer already told us, £22 billion of a hole in the UK's finances, and of course we're going to feel the chill factor from that.
If I know one thing about Northern Ireland, it is that unless things are nailed on with actual detail, a start and end time, the money to pay for it, how it's going to happen, often it does not happen. So what level of detail is going to be in this document?
Well, I don't think we're going to get the level of detail that many people out there want to see in this particular paperwork. I think the executive ministers will go as far as they can in terms of what they set out. It'll be laying out what the proposed action is going to be and how that proposed action is going to be measured on the other end. I don't think, for instance, we're going to see what level they want to cut waiting lists to in Northern Ireland. We might get a timeline in terms of what they manage to achieve over a period of the next year or so, but I don't think we're going to get much to be able to drill down into, or indeed to hold ministers to account at some stage in the future to say, look, you set a target, you didn't meet it. So I think the executive today is going to be mindful of all of that. So we're going to get lots of talk about positivity. We're also going to get lots of talk about brave decisions need to be taken by the executive, challenging times ahead. But I think if we're looking for the nitty gritty, if we're looking for those details that we can hang our hat on, if so to speak, we're not going to get them today.
And our 9 priorities and not an awful lot.
Well, it is, Stephen, but I think the point will be made today that this is not so much about addressing these priorities over the course of the next 2.5 years. It's very much about laying the groundwork for many of these priorities to be dealt with beyond the next election, because I think that's going to be in the minds of our politicians today. There's only so much they can do before the end of the mandate. But I think they wanted to cover all bases today, and that's why they set the 9 priorities last week, because they know that there are big demands on many fronts, not least, for instance, ending violence against women and girls. And we know on that front, Stephen, there is a strategy sitting waiting to be published. That's going to be published, we believe, in the next fortnight or so. And we also have some details as well, Stephen, around what's going to happen in terms of reforming public services. Now, gone are the days that the draft programme for government would drop in your inbox before it was published in the Assembly. What we do understand, though, is that we're going to get some sort of reform and transformation unit to try and manage change. And that's going to be part of a wider reform package. Some talk of $230 million being ploughed in that direction as well to try and make public services better in Northern Ireland, but also, crucially, making more financially sustainable.
Okay. And thanks very much indeed. Thank you.
Thank you, Stephen.
Right, the DP MLA, Jonathan Buckley with us this morning, the Alliance MLA, Owen Tennyson with us, and the SLP's Colin McGrath with us as well, the SLP MLA, Colin McGrath. Good morning, Colin.
Good morning, Stephen.
Good morning, Owen.
Good morning, Stephen.
Good morning. Morning, Jonathan.
Good morning, Stephen.
Right, Jonathan, stump up here. You all want it back in. You're back in. What are your party going to deliver for the people listening right now?
Well, firstly, Stephen, can I just, before I go into the details on the draft programme for government, just pass on my party's sympathies to the officer involved in the collision yesterday, and I do hope that he is on the road to recovery. In relation to the draft programme for government, obviously it's a positive news that it is being laid before the Assembly today.
It's only positive if it's worth anything.
Well, Stephen, regardless of that point, we have to understand that from a transparency and an accountability point of view, a draft programme for government, which will ultimately go now for public consultation, is a positive thing. It sets out priorities. It's going to be difficult. We know that. We know the budgetary backdrop in which we operate under. But with a multi-party programme for government, that in itself has challenges. And we know we are not going to be able to do everything. So like any MLA, I'm looking forward to seeing that detail. But for the DUP, key manifesto commitments, which we wanted to ensure were in this draft programme, which are issues on childcare, waiting lists, special educational needs. Those are key issues for the party, and we are continuing to fight and deliver on those.
I think, Jonathan, the test that some people might have is, look, is it a load of owl waffle? Or when you talk about accountability, will there be the level of detail in there so that we can look at Stormont and say, OK, in 2 years' time, they promised it, they delivered it, well done, or they promised it, or they didn't promise much, and it's a load of owl waffle. What do you think is in it?
Well, on the point, firstly, of what's in it, I think we've already seen some of the key areas that have been identified, and I don't believe anybody should prioritise or count issues such as tackling waiting lists, you know, affordable childcare, tackling violence against women and girls as waffle. It's not. It's certainly very serious issues that we need to take seriously.
Sorry, the issues are waffle, but the issues are very important, anything but waffle. But it's whether there is the detail in it, Jonathan, to tackle it, isn't it?
Yeah, I know. It's an absolute valid point. And I think what we'll see today is obviously whenever it's published, MLAs will get a chance to drill over the detail, as will the media outlets. But we have to remember, in the current context that we live, we know that Northern Ireland is funded by low need. In fact, it was the DUP that had been reiterating that point from as far back as when Philip Hammond was Chancellor. This has been a consistent point, and our services are at breaking point, and we need to understand that as a political entity, we cannot do everything, but we must prioritise what are the key priorities for working people. And I just want to say from a DUP perspective, let's take childcare, for example. 7 months ago, the DUP took on the Department of Education because we said we wanted to fix childcare. Now, Stephen, within 7 months, Paul Given and his team designed a scheme that slashed childcare bills by a further 15%, saving working parents up to £160 per month. Now, that's a significant and incredible achievement on its own, but there's much more work to be done. And hopefully with this draft programme for government, we can start to see more detail on these issues to see how, number one, they're going to be funded and how we're going to achieve the objectives.
So Owen Tennyson, there's Jonathan Buckley presenting to the public this morning a real change that their minister, Paul Given, has delivered to the public, a 15% cut in childcare costs. What real change has your minister, Naomi Long, delivered?
Well, Stephen, first of all, what I want to say in terms of the programme for government is it is significant that we've got to this point, that we have four parties coalescing around a set of priorities. And we have made significant progress in a number of areas. First of all, Naomi, when she came back, made significant strides in terms of public sector pay within the PSNI. And I know Naomi intends this week to set out some of her legislative priorities in terms of hate crime and other issues as well. So we are making significant strides. If you look at what we have managed to achieve in terms of DERA, we've published the Lough Neagh Action Plan, and I know Andrew Muir is working incredibly hard in terms of bringing forward other important strategies in terms of the environment strategy, for example, in order to make progress in those areas. So, Stephen, we are in a better place than if we didn't have government. You have to look back as far as 2016 was the last time that we actually had a programme agreed by an executive.
It's actually 2011, isn't it?
You have to go back to 2011 before you find a programme for government that we actually consulted upon and adopted. So it is really significant that we've got to this point today. And I think there is a collective endeavour. I mean, Jonathan talked correctly around childcare. We were absolutely involved in terms of shaping the childcare proposals. The executive as a collective body ring-fenced the funding to make that available to childcare. And I think that's what the public expect. They want parties to be putting their shoulder to the wheel and working together for the people of Northern Ireland. We are of course constrained. We can't do everything. We're in a truncated mandate because we lost 2 years at the beginning of this mandate. And we're also constrained by our finances. But there's a duty on all of us, I think, to pursue the kind of political and financial reform which is needed to unlock progress. And we're committed to that. We have a motion in the Assembly tomorrow, for example, setting out a pathway in terms of our funding formula and fiscal policy that we want to see at a UK level, and which we think will enable the executive to deliver better.
And given that your minister is the Justice Minister, and we've got this, it's a very broad term in the list of priorities so far, until we see the details, safer communities. Would the Chief Constable be entitled to be shocked if there wasn't more money for policing?
Well, Stephen, as a party, we have consistently argued that policing and justice is underfunded. Since the Department of Justice was devolved in 2010, we have seen a year-on-year squeeze on the DOJ budget, and that has, of course, had an impact on policing. We know the policing numbers are too low. And Naomi, to her credit, was making that point in talks with the UK government in December and has been making that point since. And as a party, we're absolutely committed to working hand in glove with the Chief Constable and with executive colleagues to deliver the additional funding that is needed for policing. There are pressures in terms of the pay award next year, and there's a real desire, I think, from all of us to get to a stage where we maximise recruitment to get policing back to the level that it needs to be, and we're committed to doing that. And I know Naomi personally...
So the Chief Constable's right to be fighting then for more money. He's right to be going to the Prime Minister, and he's right to be saying he will not allow policing numbers to go any lower, right?
Well, we've all been making that case, Stephen. I've made that case in the Assembly. Naomi has made that case. I mean, I think some of what we've seen in the past couple of weeks has been mounting out of molehill stuff, where permanent secretaries will have individual responsibility for managing public money and for lines.
Permanent secretary did it with the consent and the permission of your leader.
Well, in terms of that point, Stephen, actually, some of this predates Naomi retaking up office again, where the previous permanent secretary was having engagement with the Chief Constable. That's not a political issue. That's a matter for civil service in terms of the lines of accountability and in terms of compliance with managing public money.
Do you think you're throwing the civil servant under the bus here?
Well, no, I'm not criticising it. I'm just saying it's not a political issue. The political issue that we're focused on is doing the work with the Department of Finance, executive colleagues and the UK government to get the additional resource that's needed, and that's what we're committed to.
Colin, bring in the second, Jonathan.
Yeah, I think on this one, Stephen, Owen and indeed Naomi Long are speaking out of both sides of their mouth. You know, they were the obstacle to the Chief Con through the Permanent Secretary in terms of his appeal directly to the Prime Minister for additional resources. He has had to go very publicly on the record to fight for his force, and I admire him for doing so. That has been backed up on calls both in Parliament, and indeed we'll probably see that today whilst the DUP have tabled a motion to debate this. But it's all about priorities, and you know, a draft programme for government certainly is an issue. So whether it's the police con fighting or the Chief Con fighting for additional resource, the Alliance Party have been an obstacle. Let's look at the education lead. The committee is focused on sexuality education is their number one priority in terms of inquiry over childcare or special educational needs, or even on health. You know, the Alliance commentary over recent weeks have been focused on puberty blockers over waiting lists and reform. So I think the Alliance Party in particular certainly now have to upfront state their priorities and show clear actions about how they're going to deliver them, because I don't think the public will tolerate this continual speaking from both sides of their mouth.
Stephen, that's nonsense. I mean, I have to respond to that. I mean, today should be an opportunity for parties to actually come together after 7 months of work to agree shared priorities, to come together to focus on the issues that really matter to the people in Northern Ireland, and that is things like safer communities. And we have a plan in terms of what we want to deliver in terms of maximising resource to policing, but also taking steps, for example, in terms of new hate crime legislation. We have been supportive and constructive in terms of those steps that have been taken in other departments around childcare. We've worked hard, despite blockages being placed in the way by others, to get progress on issues like Loch Ness, and I think it just lays bare where Jonathan's priorities are, that he wants to turn this into a party political slang and match. On a day
my priorities really are the people's priorities, Owen.
That should be a significant, that should be a significant day for Northern Ireland.
Colin McGrath.
That we're able to coalesce around a programme for government and make progress for the future. And we are committed and won't be distracted by this nonsense. We are committed to delivering upon the commitments made.
Colin McGrath, this is, as Owen is saying, this is a programme for government. In other words, this is an agreement between the political parties and the executive, the four of them, as to what their priorities will be. And if you listen to Jonathan and Owen, it's clear, Colin, that there's certainly disagreement within the political parties as to who's making priorities and where they should be.
Indeed, Stephen, this, as you say, is the first time, I think, in 13 years that we've got a multi-party programme for government, which is supposed to have unity of purpose for an executive. And we haven't got the half nine yet. We've got two of those parties lifting lumps of each other in your show. So I don't think that it bodes very well for what's going to take place for the rest of today. And I think as well, if we look at what the programme for government's going to be, and I don't think that we'll be any much the wiser by the end of today than we are at the start of it. And by that, what I mean is we're not going to know the how, the when, and how we will measure any of the...
Well, if we don't know the how and when, how is that document worth the paper it's written on?
Well, that's exactly what I fear will happen today, because what we need to be able to see is here are the priorities of this executive. And look, what we saw what was produced in 2016 and was never delivered. And I fear whenever we see the nine priorities that were mentioned last week, that we move into the territory of all things for all people. We want to grow the economy. We want safer communities. We want to reduce waiting times. Well, of course we do. The public have been crying out for these things for the last number of years. And the fact that we haven't had even the production of a programme for government in over 8 years is because the place has constantly been collapsed since that. And that's why today we'll be calling once again for a covenant from all
of those.
Part of
that non-delivery included when your party was in the executive.
But what we're talking about here is a covenant to make sure that we don't collapse the institutions again, so that we can have the stability that allows the delivery. But that delivery has to be for a programme of government that says this is what we're going to do, this is how we're going to do it, this is what we're going to spend to deliver these programmes, and this is how you'll know that we've done it. If it doesn't contain all of that detail today, then what we have is a wish list, which will be there until such time as they collapse the institutions again in the future.
It's about priorities, Colin, and just because your party's in opposition does not mean that you shouldn't be asked about policies and where you would put your priorities. For example, where would Casement Park be in the SDLP's list of priorities?
Well, in our list of priorities, we've got a plan for change, which we're launching in the Stormont Hotel, which gives all of the detail of the priorities that we would have. I've excused myself from that to come and speak to you, but I will let our team detail exactly what our priorities are. We're doing that at the moment, and we will have that detail.
Do you think Casement Park should be in a list of priorities?
We have already. We're very clear on the record on our views for Casement Park. I don't think you need to ask me this morning what it is. We're exceptionally clear that that needs to be delivered. We believe that there is a massive economic benefit that can be brought from that if we have it in time for those European championships.
Your party and colleague, for example, Daniel McCrossan, is saying that that the executive must prioritise support for those living in poverty. Yes. Would Casement Park come below or above that?
It's not about either or. The executive has
priorities, a lot... Priorities are about either or.
The executive has a massive amount of resource at its availability to be able to deliver on multiple priorities. It doesn't have to pick one or other. It can do lots of priorities. That's what our plan for change will contain today, and you'll be able to bring our representatives back on for the rest of this week to discuss that plan that we're publishing.
Okay, thank you, Colin. Jonathan, can I check something? Because you've said that the Education Minister has delivered up to 15% cuts for childcare. Isn't that right?
Yeah, certainly 15% saving for working parents, which equates to roughly about £160 per month at a maximum. So, and there's roughly 12,000 people that are benefiting from that this month with reduced bills through the scheme.
So just keep me right with this. I see within the 9 priorities that we know about already, delivering affordable childcare is in there. Yeah. So if Paul has already done that, does this mean maintaining that or does this mean enhancing that 15%?
It would mean enhancement, Stephen. There's more work to be done in relation to the childcare sector, whether it's bringing stability to the sector overall and also looking at further reductions in time. But obviously, the minister has to work within funding parameters, and that certainly will be the priority going forward. But I want to just touch on a point made by Colin from the SDLP, and you talked at the start of the programme about a load of waffle. Well, I think what we've heard is a lot of sometimes articulate waffle from the SDLP in these matters, because they're very good at bringing motions to the Assembly, calling on an executive to act in certain ways. And when we had a Conservative government, we were told the big bad Tories that a Labour government would remove all ills. Well, here we have Colin McGrath, whose party is in a sister party relationship with the SDLP. In fact, they sit on the same benches. Where is the SDLP motion today to counter the disgraceful action by a Labour government to cut winter fuel payment? I mean, these are real issues that affect people. These are about priorities.
Your minister cut the winter fuel payment.
No, Stephen.
Your minister.
The Labour government
It's a devolved issue.
Rather than break parity, the executive agreed to stay in line. But what I'm trying to say, Stephen, is that
it was a decision by Gordon Lyons.
It was a decision by the Labour government
to cut
winter fuel payments. Now, let's finish it out, Stephen, because you're trying to put it in a very, very simplistic way. Once the Labour government announced that they were cutting winter fuel payment for over 10 million pensioners, some earning as little as 13,000 a year, rather than break parity, the executive, through its obviously budget constraints, has had to keep parity with the rest of the United Kingdom. But instead of fighting the case, where have the SDLP been, the opposition, in compelling and fighting for the funding to be restored by the Labour Party? They've been silent on the matter. So whenever we hear criticism today about a draft programme for government and obviously going out to public consultation, let me hear the words of condemnation from the SDLP about fighting for pensioners and those in low income. We talked about Daniel McCrossan, and fighting for those that are in poverty. Well, many pensioners will go cold this winter through actions directly from the Labour Party, and I think that's absolutely lamentable, and it's something that we collectively need to fight tooth and nail to see restored.
That's for you, Colin.
I mean, obviously, I'm sure Jonathan, if he has siblings, will know that siblings can also have arguments. I don't think we're very supportive of this decision that was rushed by this executive at 3:30 on a Friday afternoon to instigate here, with no attempt to try and instigate any form of help or assistance for those that would be most in need. I don't think any of us in the SDLP will be holding back and saying that there will be pensioners that will be worse off as a result of this, that they will face challenges, and we need our executive to be able to stand up and deliver the mitigations against that, because I certainly am totally against the removal of funding from those pensioners that are most in need, that will be left cold over this winter. But our executive has the powers to be able to address that, but I can guarantee you that it's very unlikely that our executive will do anything to help them.
So, Jonathan,
you haven't spoken to him.
So, Jonathan, why in the list of priorities, in other words, the programme for government, which your party signed up to, and it'll be the same question to you, Owen, why didn't you put pensioners and protecting them from the cold in your programme from government?
Well, when we look at the broader 9 priority areas, I'm certain whenever it comes to housing and home, you will find priorities in relation to that. But again, it does come down to the wider funding envelope, Stephen. I know your show have covered this time and time again, but the multi-year budgeting that we're going to require in years to come to look at these matters in the longer term is simply not there. And, you know, I know there is parties, and it has been highlighted in your show before, about the need for more taxation. And I would caution on that point as well, because at a time when taxation is at an all-time high, there are people that are struggling, people working families.
Millionaires aren't struggling, are they?
No, and I'm not talking about them, Stephen, but nobody can deny that there are pensioners on that threshold in around £13,000 a year that are really struggling.
So why didn't your minister, Gordon Lyons, not try to fight for at least more mitigation for those pensioners that are just outside that threshold? This is a devolved assembly.
Because he simply did not have the budget available to make the difference, Stephen. And you know something, that's regrettable.
So pensioners weren't a priority for Stormont?
That case continues to be fought, but I think you're conflating the two issues, because we will see a vote in Parliament coming up, I think it's tomorrow, on this very issue. I would still urge, even at this stage, that Colin and indeed the SDLP put pressure and indeed conversations with their sister party in the of Labour to ensure that this issue is reversed, because it will be hugely damaging. And in the overall context, we need to now collectively fight for that reform and efficiency to ensure that we don't have a case of raised taxes, but also that we can fund services to need.
Owen, how much did your party fight for those pensioners, and why did your party sign up to taking that winter fuel payment off those pensioners?
Well, we objected to the UK government, Stephen, and we wrote to them and warned them against the course of action that we were taking. But social security is an issue that is devolved in some senses in name only, where we have the legislative power but not the funding to make significant changes. But that doesn't mean that we are sitting on our laurels. We have been proactive. We're calling for an awareness campaign locally to ensure that those who are eligible for pension credits, so the most needy can still that they sign up for pension credits, that the most needy can still access those winter fuel payments, but also that we need to look at issues around discretionary support for those that are just outside the threshold to ensure that they get additional support this winter. So we are being proactive, but I want to say this.
Hold on a moment. Look at the issues for discretionary support this winter. It's the middle of September. So if the decision isn't made soon, the pensioners are sitting in the cold.
And this is a decision, Stephen, that was landed on us by the UK government without consultation. So we have been making those representations directly to the Department for Communities, because we do want to see action taken very quickly. But I want to nail a point, Stephen. I mean, I think Jonathan's contribution this morning has been utterly juvenile and has led by the lack of respect he has, not only for members of the opposition, but for his own partners in government. And I think whatever we agree in this programme for government, it has to come with a significant change in attitude, because ultimately parties have to be able to work constructively together to deliver for all of the people in our community. And I don't think we've seen evidence of that from some quarters of the DUP in recent days and months. I think there also needs to be an element of contrition, Stephen. Part of the reason why we are where we are is because we've had Brexit, which has damaged the UK economy and public finances. It's because we had the Truss mini budget, which the DUP championed. It's because we have had stop-start government at the behest of the DUP. And we're now in a very difficult situation trying to pick up the pieces. And I think we would be far better, rather than rehearsing all of that history and going round in circles and pointing the finger, actually trying to work constructively together to address it. So I hope today, after the announcement of the programme for government, we will see that change in attitude and approach to enable us to make
So Jonathan, stop being juvenile and be more cohesive around the executive with your partners in it.
I think that language from Owen is quite regrettable, Stephen, because, you know, something, it's my duty as an elected representative to hold other political parties to account, as well as those executive parties. And I'm a backbench MLA in the same sense as Owen. But it's important to be honest, because, you know, Owen can wax lyrical about his cohesive approach towards the opposition and towards other political parties. But at times it doesn't match reality. And we're actually seeing that play out in relation to the Chief Constable and his fight for additional funding. But even on the issue of, for example, childcare, Alliance actually raised concerns at the executive when a budget was agreed around ring fencing $25 million for childcare. So, you know something, I make no apology for being honest with your listeners, Stephen, to try to fight for what I believe are the people's priorities. At times I'll not win all those fights. I respect that and I understand that. And you know something? There'd be different opinions right across political parties in this assembly. That's the nature of government here. But we have to be realistic about what's deliverable and be honest with the people.
And finally,
the funding envelope we have and the priorities for them.
Finally, we haven't talked about health yet, and we can bring more detail to our top story this morning, the story that we led with, of that police officer lying on the ground for 2 hours in East Belfast, Owen. We now understand it was a Category 2 call. So therefore, the ambulance service should have responded to that, would have wanted to respond to that within 18 minutes. And that police officer lay on the ground for over 2 hours. So what are the Alliance Party's ideas as to how we fix the health service?
Well, look, the story that you broke this morning is absolutely harrowing, Stephen, and my thoughts first and foremost are with the officer and their family, and I wish them a speedy recovery. I think we do need to be able to account for both the clinical and the security risk whenever we're dealing with officers who have been injured in the course of duty. In terms of our proposals around health, we had the Mingo review of our health service in terms of systems, not structures, and that report in 2016, and we still don't have a coherent action plan or vision for transformation of our health service. And indeed, whilst executive parties often come together and talk about the need for a transformation, once we talk about a change in their local area, the local MLA is out with a placard saying, not on my watch. And I think we need, again, a shift in attitude on those issues. We have seen changes in Alliance constituencies, like in North Down, where Alliance has actually shown leadership and supported change where we believe that's necessary and can deliver better outcomes for the people that we represent. So we need that action plan to be forthcoming swiftly from the Health Minister in terms of a vision for how services are going to be used differently. And then we need buy-in from all political parties and a mature approach in terms of delivering that change. Because if we don't make those changes and transform our health service, Stephen, it will transform itself through collapse. And I don't think that's an outcome that any of us should wish to count on.
Jonathan Buckley, just the precise detail around this police officer this morning, it was 2 hours and 3 minutes he lay at the side of the road waiting for an ambulance, and it should have been just 18 minutes. That's just indicative of where our health service is at. Will your party support Mike Nesbitt getting the majority share of the extra money that's going to be dedicated to these 9 priorities?
Yeah, Stephen, it's certainly something that all parties will have to give due consideration to, given the situation that we find
ourselves. Well, you have considered it. It's in the programme for government, isn't it?
Yes, my point is the wider assembly, Stephen. Obviously, that's a draft programme for government, which will go out for public consultation, which we will see more detail on waiting lists. And then following that public consultation period, it will be up to political parties to support the health minister where necessary. And you know something, I make no apology for saying that regardless of what political party it has the health department, they need support. And, you know, we won't be behind the scenes in terms of trying to fight for that additional funding, the reform and efficiency that's required. But it's not, we all know it's a difficult financial situation, but we do need to see plans now from the health department as to what that reform and what that tackling of waiting lists looks like in terms of timeframes.
Jonathan, thanks for coming on this morning. Owen, before you go, did your party fight to keep Stephen Farrey?
We did, Stephen.
He's announced his resignation.
I'm really gutted that Stephen has taken the decision to step back. Look, Stephen Farrey has, over the past 8 years, been absolutely instrumental in shaping and growing the Alliance Party, and over the past 30 years has been a stalwart in terms of commitment to public service and progressive politics, and he's a real personal inspiration of mine. And I'm really gutted to see him go. And I think many of your listeners, Stephen, will
Why is he gone then?
Well, because he's no longer an elected representative, and Stephen took that decision that it was the right time for him to take a step back in terms of the deputy leadership role. But Stephen, I think many of
could
your
he not have been
be
co-opted
familiar.
Into Saoirse Eastwood's seat?
He could have, and look, those are, I know you intend to speak to Stephen, those are questions for Stephen. I very much wanted to see Stephen remain part of the Alliance family, but I respect Stephen's decision, and I know he will continue to be part of the Alliance family, irrespective of whether he's in frontline politics.
But I want to ask you, and sorry to cut across you, I want to ask you about Alex Kane, who's a respected commentator in Northern Ireland, and he was replying to a tweet in which someone said there will be a bloodbath in the Alliance Party now. Stephen Farrey is a massive loss. And Alex responded, he certainly was, and was for quite some time a key strategist. There will be pressure on Naomi Long, that's for sure, says Alex. But is there someone bold enough, popular enough, to make a move against her? So Alex is floating the idea that there may be a leadership challenge within your party.
I can assure you, Stephen, that is complete and utter nonsense. Alex's views may be informed by his own experiences within the Ulster Unionist Party in times gone by, but I can assure Alex that Alliance is a much more cohesive party. We're a team. Naomi has our full confidence and support. And there's absolutely no chance of that happening. In terms of Stephen's role, Stephen, I want to say this, and that is that I think your listeners will be familiar with Stephen's intellect on issues like Brexit, and he has a real legacy in that regard. But what I think people don't necessarily know about Stephen is that behind the scenes, he has a heart that's as big as his brain. And he's been a real support to those of us who have joined the party and come through the ranks under his leadership. And we'll really miss having him around the table.
And final question, Owen, you say your party is a team. What's the relationship like between Saoirse Eastwood and Naomi Long?
It's good, Stephen. I mean, we are a team. We are all pulling in the same direction, unlike other parties. We have shared priorities and ambitions. And I don't even understand the premise of the question, really.
Well, the premise of the question is, obviously, I see Saoirse's tweets. She's very proud to be an MP. I see her over there. She's telling the public she's very proud to be it. You've lost now Stephen Farry, a massive person in your party. We're going to talk to Stephen imminently. But I just wonder, when you say you are all a team, what the relationships are actually like. You must disagree with each other within the senior members of your team.
Well, no, actually. I mean, of course, there are day-to-day discussions about strategies and decisions, as there are in any party, but genuinely, we share the same values. I mean, myself and Saoirse, for example, we've come up through the party together at the same time. We have a really good working relationship. I think we're all immensely proud of Saoirse's success and the work that she's doing at Westminster. I think some of this, Stephen, to be honest and candid with you, is the media gaze. Whenever you have strong female personalities in particular, that there's sort of a media narrative that develops that there must be some kind of catfight or there must be something happening behind the scenes. It's just not true. It's just nonsense. We have a really talented bunch of people. We work really coherently and well together. And I'm really proud to be in the party that I am, where that's the case, where there are so many people who punch above their weight. And I don't think that can be said for other political parties.
Thanks for coming on this morning, Owen. Appreciate it. Well, the man we're talking about, Stephen Farry, joining us now. Good morning to you, Stephen.
Good morning, Stephen.
Well, that was pretty flattering, that your heart is as big as your brain, Stephen. But your party didn't co-opt you into Saoirse's seat. Why not?
Well, I didn't even seek the co-option, so it was a runner. No, and I mean, I made very, very clear right at the outset that it wasn't something on the cards. And I mean, at that time, Stephen, I mean, whenever that seat opened up, I just run for election in North Down, and it was asking the people of North Down to put their trust in me for another 5 years. Now, that didn't happen. And for me, then, to simply 1 week later to move to another constituency, I think would have been highly cynical. And indeed, I mean, Lacken Valley in particular has had an issue in recent times about people moving in from the outside to seek representation. And I think that the people of Lacken Valley, we don't need to be abused in that way in terms of people just coming and going and taking their votes for granted. So that was my view right from the very start. And I mean, I'm looking at other things, Stephen, at the moment.
And we'll talk
outside
about that.
Party politics in any event. So that's where my future ambitions lie.
Well, and we'll talk about that, Stephen. But look, you know how it works. I know how it works. A party can fight for you. Owen has said this morning that, yes, your party fought to keep you. You've just told me that they didn't have a conversation with you about co-opting you. So,
I made it very, very clear right at the start that was not something I wanted to do.
Okay.
So that was my choice. I mean, in theory, that option was open to me, but for many reasons, I didn't think it was the right thing to do. And I mean, yes, and the party, I mean, is keen for me to stay on. I mean, I didn't have to step down as deputy leader. I was only re-elected that post at the party AGM at the end of May. In theory, I could have stayed on in that post for the full 12 months. And the people wanted me to do that, but this is my own personal decision. I think the timing was right to step back. And in doing so, it gives me a bit more freedom to speak out on some issues and also to look at some other opportunities as well. So it was very much a personal decision on my part. And I mean, I've been in active politics for 30 years through many ups and downs, and we've had some good times more recently. And I think it's now time for me to see how I can contribute to Northern Ireland and further afield through some other means.
See, you've just goaded me. You know what you're at, Mr. Farry. Gives you more freedom, you've just said to the presenter. to speak out. So how would you vote with regards to a united Ireland? You now have the freedom, Stephen.
Straight on that particular question, you've just told me you would have the freedom.
How would you vote today, now that you have the freedom, how would you vote?
And Stephen, I'm going to say exactly the same thing I would have said just 6 months ago.
So you have the freedom, but you still don't want to.
Well, the issue is this has to be an evidence-driven decision. So at the moment, there is no option of a border poll on the ballot paper at this moment in time. There may well be in the next few years. And indeed, I'm happy to take part in those discussions and debates. We need to have robust discussions around all the different aspects of that statement. And I will be driven by the evidence.
With that newfound freedom, speak out then. What are you talking about? What issues are you talking about?
Well, I mean, that remains to be seen. I'm talking to various people. I can't go into details at that stage. We will see where I end up over the next number of weeks.
But you just said a few seconds ago, didn't you? It'll be outside politics. You're gone.
No, I think what I'm looking to do is outside party politics. I remain very much committed to the vision and values, policies of the party. So that's clear cut. I'm in contact with people behind the scenes. I'm still acting deputy leader until a successor's put in place in that regard. So continuity is important in that particular
respect. Who should take over,
Stephen? We have 17 people who are eligible to go for it. It's a much bigger field than
the
United States
in
the past. It would be extremely unfair, Stephen, for me to pick one or two names. I think it's for those people to come forward. And I think we have many, many talented people coming through. And any one of them could step into my shoes and do a wonderful job.
Saoirse Eastwood was your prodigy. She was your prodigy, Stephen. Should it not be Saoirse?
I have helped many, many people in their careers over the past. Absolutely, I have worked very closely with Saoirse on a whole range of issues over the past.
Would she make a good deputy leader?
Absolutely delighted, and she would make a good deputy leader in the same way several others would make a very good deputy leader.
So this what you're moving on to. Come on now, give us a sense of what's in your head. You've been a big character in Northern Ireland. People have listened to you often on this programme. Give us a wee bit more than just ducking the question. What are you looking to do, Stephen?
In all serious statement, first of all, the timing of this decision was driven by our meeting of our party council, which happened on Saturday. And so the reason I announced it at this stage was because I wanted them to hear it first, given they were the people who put me in that post. And that's just a matter of respect. So as things stand, it's a fluid situation. I'm having a number of conversations with different people as to how I can play a future role in terms of Northern Ireland and beyond.
Look, I'm not smart enough for all this. What are you talking about? Doing what?
It depends where those things land, Stephen. But let's put it this way. I mean, you have a programme for government being published today. I think it's fair to say that Northern Ireland and indeed other societies are probably facing a bigger range of challenges today in terms of budgets and the issues such as climate change that are mounting up than they have at any stage in recent times. One thing I'm very conscious of is that we end up as politicians getting caught up in a 5-year electoral cycle, and we have a lot of short-termism. We have a lot of populism in that respect. The same way in terms of the UK fiscal rules, for example, it's all driven by what happens in that very window. Whenever I talk about freedom, I'm trying to see the opportunity of moving beyond what you can and can't say within that window whenever you're chasing votes, and actually maybe look at some of the more harder realities that are facing our society and looking at the sort of the longer-term solutions. So as far as to say that gives you a bigger clue as I can at this stage, Stephen.
When you're talking about that freedom, will you remain a member of the Alliance Party?
Exactly what I can't do will be determined exactly where I end up in terms of an opportunity. And so that is a fairly fluid situation.
So you may be leaving your membership of the Alliance Party.
That will all be driven by what emerges. It won't be by choice. It will be by circumstance. But it very much depends exactly where I end up and what's.
Have you been made an offer? You're considering it, or are you seeking a role?
No, I am talking to people at this stage, Stephen, and we will see what crystallizes over the coming days. So, again, I'm not announcing a resignation to move straight away into something else. See, conversations are still ongoing.
The reason why I'm intrigued by you saying that you might have to leave your membership of the Lions Party is a member of the public can be a member of a political party. So why would you have to leave, possibly have to leave, your membership of the party?
Well, and you asked me a question, Stephen. I can't give you, I mean, my desire is to stay a member of the party, but it's depending on exactly what I do in the future. I mean, for example, there are a number of public sector roles where, I mean, your impartiality is absolutely crucial in that respect. I'm not saying that's necessarily where I'm going, but just to make that point. So there always is going to be a trade-off in that particular respect. And if you look back through the history of the Alliance Party, you go back, for example, to the 1970s, where you had someone like Bob Cooper, who was a leading figure in the party, who then moved into a prominent public sector role. So those things happen. That's just by way of an example. It doesn't necessarily mean that's where I'm going. But Stephen, we're always happy to speak to you down the line anyway. I've always enjoyed our conversations over the years. And if I tell you a wee anecdote before I go, I first spoke to you, I think it was back in the early 2000s, whenever you were on Silly Beat, and I was asked to go on this show, this new presenter, on a Saturday night, and I thought it could be this nice fluff piece. And all of a sudden, I was attacked from all sides and went, well, where'd that come from?
That was when I was back in BCR, was it? In community radio?
That was it, absolutely.
It's a long time ago, Stephen. I'll share an anecdote. I once met you on a sunny day in Bangor in your shorts, and I haven't recovered since.
Indeed, absolutely. No one should have to be inflicted with that now.
Listen, good luck for the future. You're not dead, so we hope to hear you.
No, absolutely, and still acting leader, so acting deputy leader. So,
thanks a lot.
Speak to you soon.
Thanks a lot, Stephen.
All the best.
Thank you.
Bye bye.
Find it hard to get up on a Monday morning. How are you all doing? Thank you for joining us on the program. You know what we do with the Nolan Show. We simply bring you the news, no holds barred. We do it our way, you do it your way, and engaging with us. And it's been a formula that's been very, very successful for the last 20-odd years. And I want to say thank you. I want to say thank you for trusting us. Thank you for listening to us every single morning at 9 o'clock. I was out with my mum yesterday in Newton Ard Shopping Centre, actually. And the amount of people coming up to me saying that you make it part of your day tuning into this programme at 9 o'clock. And then I had a lady sat with me for about 20 minutes and she was talking about all of these different news issues. And that's what this is all about. So if you want on air, if you want in front of hundreds of thousands of people, then tune into this programme and call us. 030 30 80 55 55. Paul's in Belfast. Morning, Paul.
Right, before I put my question to you, I want to ask you about the two voices you have. You have a voice for Radio 5 and a voice for the Nolan Show.
Look at you, Paul. You've been with me years. And you're very rarely happy, but you always call us and then you always have a pop.
No, you have this wee played voice for the Radio 5 and then you have the Belfast
do
voice.
You?
Oh, you do, huh?
Right.
We got Ballygum Martin Road voice.
so you listen to me on 5 Live as well?
I listen to you all the time, huh?
All right,
I'm probably like a stalker.
Well, I do not have a voice for 5 Live.
Okay, well, I think everybody knows you do.
It's good to hear you laugh. It's the first time I've heard you laughing in many years. What's wrong with you? You on the happy pills?
It's bright and sunny out there, so... More of a serious issue. Like, I go back to being serious again. No, see, when you talk about these nine priorities of a government, right? Each one of them is linked. Each one of them is linked to each other. But the one that I would like to speak about here today is the housing issue. Right? I was born the same year as you, 1973.
I'm better looking though.
I'm sure you are. You know what I mean? But you haven't seen me, and you haven't seen me. I'm a budgie smuggler yet.
He's definitely on something this morning.
No, there's been pictures of you and budgie smugglers about.
What is this man on? Hurry up!
No, what I would like to say is this. The housing issue, right, where I was born in Ballymurphy, right, the housing issues has been a problem from day one, right? Now, the vast majority of houses in Ballymurphy have been bought now, and they look good. People love their homes, right? But only giving you as an example that when you build good, quality social housing, people look after it and people want to live in it. But see, when you have 47,000 people or cases on the wait list in the housing sector, then the vast majority of them are people from Northern Ireland. Their families and their friends support them on these housing lists. They can take the burden and strain from them. But when you have people coming in from other countries, men, women and children, that don't have any support structure, they're totally and utterly dependent on the state, put them in emergency housing, then they go straight to the top and they go in these brand new builds because they've no support. As for when the old units to come up vacant, right? This is an issue. Listen, I'm opposite of racist. I'm the opposite of racist. I can't stand it. I despise it. But the point is this, is that if you have a country now that the housing list is bigger now than it was in 1973, or the year I was born, where have we moved forward? What gains have we made?
Well, I can't remember now. Do you support Sinn Féin?
No, listen, I was a Sinn Féin supporter all my life, but there's times when I haven't been happy. I think Sinn Féin can be very naive when they try to do this cross.
What are they doing for social housing? What is that? Now the biggest party in Northern Ireland, what are they doing?
Sinn Féin has policies that they try to implement in the same way across the border. They do with water charges and they do with housing, right? They try to have us all Ireland policy, right?
Well, they don't support water charging in Northern Ireland.
No, that's what I'm saying. They're against water charging in all forms in the south and the north. But I have supported Sinn Féin most of my life, right? But I'm going to tell you this, right? I support Sinn Féin again, right? Because I think the Sinn Féin is the only party, really, that will, if they get the money, will bring a change to society needs here. But don't have the money. If you can't raise money in your own country, if you don't have taxing powers, I'm not talking about just changing the rates system. I'm talking about proper taxing powers. If you don't have them...
They do.
Then what does it have? Explain
they do, me. Paul. So they're the biggest party in Northern Ireland. They're highly influential in Northern Ireland. It is Sinn Féin who have delivered statement after statement ruling out raising revenue. Some of that revenue... they could be part of pumping back in to social housing. So when Michelle O'Neill stands up or Sinn Féin stands up and rules out and look, I am in the wealthier category, so it'll be people like me that'll get hit harder if they were to raise revenue. But Sinn Féin's one of those political parties which has ruled many different revenue-raising measures out. And there are consequences of that. And the consequences are less money for projects like housing.
Ben, what raising powers will they have? You're talking about rate changes.
They could put up water rates. They could put up prescription charges. They could charge people who have massive properties, very valuable properties. They could choose to do it, and they are politically choosing to not do it.
But Stephen, when they raise tax and they get, like, say they put extra on road tax, right? Say they have the power to do that. That money's not just going to go in to improve the road and the potholes.
Yep.
That money, like every bit of taxation that they raise, will be spread amongst the health service, education, and then down the line it'll be housing. Right, but the road tax is
a red herring, Paul. Right, because you're right. That money would go into the central exchequer,
central pocket,
the treasury. You're 100% right. But the reality is, this executive and Sinn Féin are the biggest political party in it.
Yeah.
Sinn Féin have not announced one measure that would take money from the rich in Northern Ireland and redistribute it to the poor in Northern Ireland. Not one extra measure.
But their measures are already in place.
Are they?
I mean, yes, there's money being tucked off the rich consistently here in Northern Ireland. Listen, I come from a very poor background. Some of my family members have done well, some of us are just getting by. And actually, hopefully my children can do better than I, but because people do better than I doesn't mean they should be hammered for it. You know, there should be other ways of raising revenue. It should be spread equally amongst everybody. I'm not talking about the very poor in society. You can't just specifically say
I'm not talking at all about the poor in society. So let's take the regional rate as an example, Paul, right?
So
the executive agreed to raise the regional rate by 4% this year, okay?
Yeah.
And Michelle O'Neill ruled out raising it by 15%, which had been floated, okay? Why did Michelle O'Neill, and by the way, the other executive parties, why did they rule out raising it by 15% for the most affluent, for the wealthiest in Northern Ireland? If you want to distinguish between the poor and the rich, I don't know if it's possible, but is it? Did that conversation happen? In other words, where is Sinn Féin, or indeed the DUP, or the Ulster Unionist Party, or the Alliance Party? Where are they targeting the rich in this country in order to redistribute the money to the poor? Where are they doing it?
Sinn Féin used to represent just the poorest in society in the 1980s. And in the 1980s, really just the poorest in society represented. Now Sinn Féin represent the very wealthy of the nationalist community, which can be a lot of people, big percentages, it isn't the way it used to be, and the middle class as well. Sinn Féin know that. They're a political party. They're not going to put themselves in a position where they're going to be voted out and the SDLP is going to start back in again. They're not going to do that. So that's the politics of it. You know, but there has to be money coming from London. Has to be. Extra money. I know people, even the South of Ireland. South of Ireland needs to put money into this. Sovereign wealth.
I'm only dwelling on Sinn Féin with you because it's in the context of you saying you were a Sinn Féin voter. This applies to other political parties too. They wanted back in to Stormont before they leveraged the more money that they say they now need from the British government. They threw away their leverage, did they not?
Well, if they go down the south of Ireland, if they speak to people in the south of Ireland and say to them, you're matching money here for Casement Park, you're matching money for this road up in the Dara, right? We want you to match money here for housing, social housing, and also towards building
more
affordable private housing. I know, but they have to do it. If a southern government is serious here about Northern Ireland, people, Catholic and Protestant together, if they're serious about being part of this place, they need to bring money in. They need to do it.
Well, you see, what I'll be looking for in this programme for government later today, Paul, right, when we all see it, I will be looking to see if these four political parties that form the executive are saying to people like you, because social housing is one of the nine priorities, I'll be looking to see if they're saying, OK, here's how many houses we aim to build. Here's the money, here's the amount of money that we will need. Here's what's dedicated towards it. And here's when they'll be built by.
That's exactly right. We need to see that. And it has to be money to back it.
Do you think you will see it?
No, we won't see it, but we have to see it. This is the things that they have to do. But if we don't see it today, they need to see it within the next weeks, not months.
Can I ask you a different question? And it's completely separate from what we're talking about today. But you're just talking about property and houses and things. You just prompted a wee bell to go off in my head. You sound like you have an understanding of Sinn Féin.
Yeah.
How much property does Sinn Féin own as a political party?
Well, look, there was a big issue concerning Sinn Féin when they stopped people buying the right to buy of a social housing. That was a big issue.
Do they have a lot of property?
Well, look, listen. See, people in Sinn Féin. People used to call them communists, even socialists, not even communists. Like, they're just ordinary people from national service who try to do well like everybody else. They're just like you and me. If they're successful, they're successful. If they're not, they're not. There's members in Sinn Féin live with their parents still. It's a truth. It's a fact. There's members in Sinn Féin have lovely big homes. But that's because they may have inherited money. They're working hard. They've jobs outside of being politicians that have done well in some type of maybe law or something, or construction. These are things that people just do in everyday life. It's no reflection on their morals or their validity as good politicians. I mean, it probably makes them better politicians if they're successful.
Paul, thanks for your call today. Good man. John and Ballyclare. Okay. Morning, John.
Good morning, Stephen.
Morning.
I just very little to say here, but it's about the super rich, yourself included. If they would pay 2% more tax There'd be no need to cut off winter fuel lines. The hospitals would be better off. 2% more. Could you afford 2% more income tax?
Well, the Labour Party have guaranteed not to put income tax up, John.
No, they're going for the easy option, the pensioners. You know, the next thing they'll be mean testing the pension. That's the next move Stammer will be at. And I heard that last caller talking about housing there. Angela Rayner said she was going to build 1 million new homes in the next 10 years. Nobody challenged her or not. That is impossible. No matter what way she does it, that is impossible. That cannot be done.
And will you be hit hard by losing the winter fuel allowance?
You know what I did with my winter fuel allowance? No, I'll not be hit hard. I give it to 3 charities, but they're not going to get it this year. That's what I did with my winter fuel allowance. I don't need it, but I give it to 3 charities. I could email you the names of them. I give it to 3 charities, £100 each, to 3 charities, but I'm not getting it this year because I don't get it. That's as simple as that. But it really annoys me because I know this is only the thin end of the wedge. The next thing it'll be, we need to mean test your pension. And if you have money in the bank, if you have property, they're going to take the pension off you.
Well, one of the other things, I was on Five Live at the weekend talking about this, John. One of the other things, look, we won't know until that budget. That budget's the 30th of October, so it's a while away. But one of the other things that certainly some of the commentators are wondering about is whether the Labour government will impose a wealth tax so that for those people, and that would include pensioners, obviously, and I'm saying that because if you bought your house 30 or 40 years ago, you know, imagine how that house is worth now compared to what it once was. And they may impose a tax, who knows, let's see, on your wealth, your assets, the total value of your assets. So if you're being hit for, I don't know, 5, 10, 15, 20 grand a year because your portfolio, your house is worth over £1 million. One of the papers was saying it could be 500 grand or more. Then you could be hit by this wealth tax.
Yeah.
But if that money's then redistributed so that social housing can be built, so that we can start to really tackle waiting lists, is it a good thing?
Well, I left school at 16, Stephen. I worked every day. I'm 72 now. I never was unemployed in my life. I'm now 72. Now, you see the Tories, I hear Labour. Every pass the buck, we're cleaning up the Tory mess. We're cleaning up the Tory mess. All these Tories are pretty rich. They're pretty rich. Tax them. Like, you know, you see somebody like myself got a house left them, a property. Say you had your own house and you got one left you, your parents or somebody left your house, and you have that house let out. They're going to crucify you again. Going to crucify people. I think it's about 80% of second homeowners are one owners, one house.
John, thank you for your call today. It's been nice to talk to you. Thank you for your call today. We're talking about some of the things that we can do with your money, that the government can do with your money, with taxpayers' money. 340 million of it has built Grand Central Station in Belfast. The BBC's Mark Simpson is there. You there now, Mark?
I certainly am, Stephen. Good morning.
Good morning. I must come down and have a wee look around. What's it look like?
Well, Steve, I think you'd be impressed. It's about the size of 2 football pitches. It might make you feel as if you're in England. It's got that English train or bus station feel to it. It's big in scale. There are going to be lots of retail outlets here. You can get your cup of coffee. You can get something to eat, all being well, when those open in the coming weeks. It's a game changer in terms of public transport here, except, of course, the trains haven't started yet.
Can you describe it a little bit more to me, Mark?
Okay, so you have 26 bus stands. So you can imagine how long that is. That's on one side of the station. On the other side, you have 8 platforms. So you think of Yitlanyan Place, where you only have 4 platforms. So it's double the size of that. You put all those bus stands together, all those train platforms together, and you get a very modern, proper transport hub.
And I guess part of the question is, will it incentivize? Is this to super serve the people already using public transport? Or might it actually incentivize, I guess, people like me to start considering using it? Is that part of their target?
I think you're spot on, Stephen. I think that's exactly the target. And let's face it, it's like going to a cinema or a sports stadium. You know, if you go there and the facilities are good, you'll want to come back. You know, if, say, you're going to Europa bus station and you feel it's a little bit out of the way, it's a bit cramped, the information isn't quite clear, you might be reluctant to go back. I would imagine people will want to go back to this station. The problem is wielding people like you and I out of our cars. There's a big car culture, isn't there, in Greater Belfast, and that's going to be the problem. Getting people like me in their 50s out of what I've been doing for, 30 or 40 years. Speaking of 30 or 40 years ago, a couple of Inst pupils have just walked past me here, Stephen. That would have been you back in the 1990s.
Absolutely. It's good to see that the best school in Northern Ireland is frequenting the place. What about this hullabaloo over, they haven't got the trains going from that station yet, Mark?
Well, everything's not on track in terms of the trains, if you pardon the pun. But I am told that if all goes according to plan, the trains should be running this time next month. So train passengers have about 3 or 4 weeks to wait. The problem is safety certification. There's training going on at the moment. The trains are actually running, but they don't have the necessarily needed certificates to allow you and I to get on.
Why not? Didn't they plan it so that they could have it by now? Did they not apply for it early enough or what?
There are two schools of thought. There is a school of thought that maybe, you know, they didn't get their applications in soon enough. I'm told that's not true. The problem is that you put in some information and maybe the authorities want a little bit more. They want to make sure, Stephen, to use this in layperson's language, that the design on paper matches what you actually see out there on the new rail link. So there'll be lots of men and women in hard hats examining the rail lines as we speak to make sure that they're secure.
When you say, and we saw this in the TransLink statement they sent us on Friday, that staff are still being trained, again, should that not all have been done before now, or is that unfair on them?
Well, it's a good question. They may be doing extra training, but you talk to Chris Conway, the chief executive of TransLink, he will say, we never said the trains were going to start in September. We were looking at October, November. So we are on track. So that's why that training is still taking place.
And how many people are down there now? Like, is this thing bustling with people or what?
It is, I have to say. We've just had a school choir. We've just had ministers visiting here, city councillors. Your old friend, the speaker from the Assembly, Edwin Poots, has just popped in before he goes back up to Stormont to chair some debate on the programme for government. Funny, I said to him, are you going to miss it? And he just said, no, they can't start without me. So he's on his way. He's on his way back up the hill. But lots of school pupils, politicians, punters and passengers as well, and plenty of journalists. You would expect that, Stephen.
Okay. Might pop down in about an hour's time. Thank you very much, Mark. Thank you, sir. All the very best. Albert's in Belfast. Morning, Albert.
Good morning, Stephen.
What are you giggling about?
Well, what I'm not giggling about is the time that you give people. You have an allocation of people ringing you, and you should basically give them roughly the same time. And, you know, what's the point now? It's like, Albert, leave him till the last couple of minutes. This has happened on previous occasions, you know.
Well, I'm sorry you feel like that, but you're spending time complaining rather than spending time talking about your point.
But this is what you do. You basically give a boy 10 minutes there, give another boy 6 minutes. Why don't you allocate a couple of minutes each for each caller?
We've literally
got... Instead of leaving people till the last minute...
Well, we literally had 4.5 minutes for you, and well, now it's down to 3 because you're complaining rather than making your point.
Yeah. And I said, well, that's my time. I'm putting a complaint into you.
Okay, well, I'm sorry,
then,
Albert.
Then you go to the Grand Central Station. You could have done that tomorrow. But anyway.
Okay.
You know, my so what a gripe this morning is, you spent basically a half an hour with our politicians and all we got was waffle, as you said. And you said there that the politicians lost their leverage when they were negotiating in Hillsborough. They knew rightly that they hadn't got enough money off the British government. And what did they do? Because they were that eager to get back into government. But my question is, what are they going to do with the money that they take off the pensioners? What is the minister going to do with that money? That's what I want you to ask him. What he's going to do with that money that he's stealing off the pensioners?
Well, Albert,
if it means, and I said to you the other day, if it means Casement Park, it would be a scandal that he would give it to Casement Park and take it off the pensioners.
Well, Albert, just on that point. The minister doesn't get the money. It's the other way round. Had the minister, he would argue, certainly, Gordon Lyons would argue, that had he not have made the decision, he would have had to find the money, find more money. This is just stopping Stormont having to find more money. Do you see what I mean?
But what they're doing is they say that they're going to go to Westminster. The same issue. Starmer has basically taken the money off the pensioners in England and Wales. How do they expect to get money off the British government? Another thing to say about Casement Park, we heard, months ago, the Secretary of State and Starmer saying, we'll get the money for Casement Park. How can they take the money off the pensioners in England and Wales? That's a scandal.
Okay.
Again, or find the money for that and give it to Casement Park. And then they talk about the maze, $300 million for the maze, but just before you go,
Albert. We have to go, I'm afraid. But listen, thank you for your call. I'm sure we'll talk again. Thanks, everybody. It's only Monday. We're back tomorrow. That'll be Tuesday at 9 o'clock. Have a good day. Thanks for listening.
The biggest show in the country. Listen again on BBC Sounds. Tweet at Stephen Nolan.
I'm Katya Adler from the Global Story podcast, where we're looking at the US election and the huge sums of money, billions of dollars being spent by Republicans and Democrats hoping to win in November. Who's donating the cash? And what impact does it all have on American democracy? The Global Story brings you fresh takes and smart perspectives from BBC journalists around the world. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.